big enough to hold bodies. The whole place smelled of death. He thought of the pulse beating beneath Inez's jaw, the warmth of her skin on his lips. He tried to shake the thought free. He did not want that memory tangling with this room full of rot. Kaz had never been able to dodge the horror of that night in the Ketterdam harbor. The memory of his brother's corpse clutched tight in his arms as he told himself to kick a little harder, to take one more breath, stay afloat, stay alive. He'd found his way to shore, devoted himself to the vengeance he and his brother were owed. But the nightmare refused to fade. Kaz had been sure it would get easier. He would stop having to think twice before he shook a hand or was forced into close quarters. Instead, things got so bad he could barely brush up against someone on the street without finding himself once more in the harbor. He was on the Reaper's barge and death was all around him. He was kicking through the water, clinging to the slippery bloat of Geordi's flesh, too frightened of drowning to let go. The situation had gotten dangerous. When Gorka once got too drunk to stand at the Blue Paradise, Kaz and Teapot had to carry him home. 6 blocks they hauled him, Gorka's weight shifting back and forth, slumping against Kaz in a sickening press of skin and stink, then flopping onto Teapot, freeing Kaz briefly, though he could still feel the rub of the man's hairy arm against the back of his neck. Later, Teapot had found Kaz huddled in the lavatory, shaking and covered in sweat. He'd pleaded food poisoning, teeth chattering as he jammed his foot against the door to keep Teapot out. He could not be touched again, or he would lose his mind completely. The next day he'd bought his first pair of gloves, cheap black things that bled dye whenever they got wet. Weakness was lethal in the barrel. People could smell it on you like blood, and if Kaz was going to bring Pekka Rollins to his knees, he couldn't afford any more nights trembling on a bathroom floor. Kaz never answered questions about the gloves, never responded to taunts. He just wore them, day in and day out, peeling them off only when he was alone. He told himself it was a temporary measure, but that didn't stop him from remastering every bit of sleight of hand wearing them, learning to shuffle and work a deck even more deftly than he could barehanded. The gloves held back the waters, kept him from drowning when memories of that night threatened to drag him under. When he pulled them on, it felt like he was arming himself, and they were better than a knife or a gun. Until he met Imogen. He'd been 14. Not yet Per Haskell's lieutenant, but making a name for himself with every fight and swindle. Imogen was new to the barrel, a year older than he was. She'd run with a crew in Zierfort, small-time rackets that she claimed had left her bored. Since she'd arrived in Ketterdam, she'd been hanging around the staves, picking up small jobs, trying to find her way into one of the barrel gangs. When Kaz had first seen her, she'd been breaking a bottle over the head of a razor gull who'd gotten too handsy. Then she'd cropped up again when Per Haskell had him running book on the spring prize fights. She had freckles and a gap between her front teeth, and she could hold her own in a brawl. One night when they were standing by the empty ring counting up the day's haul, she touched her hand to the sleeve of his coat, and when he looked up, she'd smiled slowly, close-lipped, so she couldn't see the gap in her teeth. Later, lying on his lumpy mattress in the room he shared at the slat, Kaz had stared up at the leaky ceiling and thought of the way Imogen had smiled at him, the way her trousers sat low on her hips. She had a sidle when she walked, as if she approached everything from a little bit of an angle. He liked it. He liked her. There was no mystery to bodies in the barrel. Space was tight, and people took their pleasures where they found them. The other boys in the dregs talked constantly about their conquests. Kaz said nothing. Fortunately, he said nothing about almost everything, so he had consistency working in his favor. But he knew what he was expected to say, the things he was supposed to want. He did want those things, in moments, in flashes. A girl crossing the street in a cobalt dress that slid from her shoulder. A dancer moving like flames in a show on East Stave. Imogen laughing like he'd told the funniest joke in the world when he hadn't said much at all. He'd flexed his hands in his gloves, listening to his roommate snore. I can best this. he told himself. He was stronger than this sickness, stronger than the pull of the water. When he'd needed to learn the workings of a gambling hall, he'd done it. When he'd decided to educate himself on finance, he'd mastered that too. Kaz thought of Imogen's slow, close-mouthed smile, and made a decision. He would conquer this weakness the way he'd conquered everything in his path. He'd started small, with gestures no one would notice. A game of three-man bramble dealt with gloves off, a night spent with them tucked under his pillow. Then, when Pear Haskell sent him and Teapot to lay a little hurt on a two-bit brawler named Benny, who owed him cash, Kaz had waited until they'd had him in the alley. And when Teapot told Kaz to hold Benny's arms, he'd slipped off his gloves just as a test, something easy. As soon as he made contact with Benny's wrists, a rush of revulsion overtook him. But he was prepared and endured it, ignoring the icy sweat that broke over him as he hooked Benny's elbows behind his back. Kaz forced himself to brace Benny's body against his, while Teapot reeled off the terms of his loan with Pear Haskell, punctuating each sentence with a punch to Benny's face or gut. "I'm all right," Kaz told himself. "I'm handling this." Then the waters rose. This time the wave was as tall as the spires on the Church of Barter. It seized him and dragged him down, a weight that he could not escape. He had Geordie in his arms, his brother's rotting fish-belly body clutched against him. Kaz shoved him away, gasping for breath. The next thing he knew, he was leaning against a brick wall. Teapot was yelling at him as Benny fled. The sky was gray above him, and the stink of the alley filled his nostrils, the ash and vegetable smell of garbage, the ripe tang of old urine. "What the hell was that, Bricker?" screamed Teapot, face mottled with fury, nose whistling in a way that should have been funny. "You just let him go! What if he had a knife on him?" Kaz registered it only dimly. Benny had hardly touched him, but somehow without the gloves, it was all so much worse. The press of skin, the pliability of another human body so close to his. "Are you even listening to me, you sorry skinny little skiv?" Teapot grabbed him by his shirt, his knuckles brushing Kaz's neck, sending another wave of sickness crashing through him. He shook Kaz until his teeth rattled. Teapot gave Kaz the beat down he'd planned for Benny and left him bleeding in the alley. He didn't get to go soft or give in to distraction, not on a job, not when one of your crew was counting on you. Kaz curled his hands into his sleeves, but never threw a punch. It had taken him nearly an hour to drag himself from that alley, and weeks to rebuild the damage to his reputation. Any slip in the barrel could lead to a bad fall. He found Benny, and made him wish Teapot had been the one to deliver the beating. He put his gloves back on and didn't take them off. He became twice as ruthless, fought twice as hard. He stopped worrying about seeming normal. Let people see a glimmer of the madness within him, and let them guess at the rest. Someone got too close, he threw a punch. Someone dared to put hands on him, he broke a wrist, two wrists, a jaw. Dirty Hands, they called him. Haskell's rabid dog. The rage inside him burned on, and he learned to despise people who complained, who begged, who claimed they'd suffered. "Let me teach you what pain looks like," he would say. And then he'd paint a picture with his fists. At the ring, the next time Imogen laid her fingers on his sleeve, Kaz held her gaze until that closed-mouth smile slipped. She dropped her hand. She looked away. Kaz went back to counting the money. Now Kaz wrapped his cane against the morgue floor. "Let's get this over with," he said to Nina, hearing his voice echo too loudly off the cold stone. He wanted out of this place as fast as possible. They started on opposite sides, scanning the dates on the drawers, searching for a cadaver that would be in the appropriate state of decomposition. Even the thought ratcheted the tension in his chest tighter. It felt like a scream building, but his mind had conceived of this plan, knowing it would bring him to this place. "Here," Nina said. Kaz crossed the room to her. They stood before the drawer, neither of them moving to open it. Kaz knew they'd both seen plenty of dead bodies. You couldn't make a life on the streets of the barrel or as a soldier in the Second Army without encountering death. But this was different. This was decay, At last, Kaz hooked the crow's head of his cane under the handle and pulled. The drawer was heavier than he'd anticipated, but it slid open smoothly. He stood back.
"We're sure this is a good idea?" said Nina.
"I'm open to better ones," said Kaz.
She blew out a long breath and then pulled the sheet away from the corpse. Kaz thought of a snake molting. The man was middle-aged, his lips already blackening with decay. As a little boy, Kaz had held his breath whenever he'd passed a graveyard, certain that if he opened his mouth, something terrible would crawl in. The room tilted. Kaz tried to breathe shallowly, forcing himself back to the present. He spread his fingers inside his gloves, felt the leather tug, grasped the weight of his cane in his palm.
"I wonder how he died,"
Nina murmured as she peered at the gray folds of the dead man's face.
"Alone," Kaz said, looking at the man's fingertips.
Something had been gnawing at them. The rats had gotten to him before his body was found. Or one of his pets. Kaz pulled the sealed glass container he'd lifted from Jenya's kit out of his pocket.
"Take what you need."
Standing in the clock tower above Colm's suite, Kaz surveyed his crew. The city was still cloaked in darkness, but dawn would soon come, and they would go their separate ways. Wylan and Colm to an empty bakery to wait out the start of the auction. Nina to the barrel with her assignments in hand. Inej to the Church of Barter to take up her position on the roof. Kaz would descend to the square in front of the exchange with Matthias and Kue and meet the armed Stadwatch troop that would escort them into the church. Kaz wondered how Van Eck felt about his own officers protecting the bastard of the barrel. He felt more himself than he had in days. The ambush at Van Eck's house had shaken him. He hadn't been ready for Pekka Rollins to re-enter the field on those terms. He hadn't been prepared for the shame of it, for the memories of Geordi that had returned with such force.
"You failed me,"
his brother's voice, louder than ever in his head. "You let him dupe you all over again." Kaz had called Jesper by his brother's name. A bad slip. But maybe he'd wanted to punish them both. Kaz was older now than Geordi had been when he'd succumbed to the Queen's Lady Plague. Now he could look back and see his brother's pride, his hunger for fast success.
"You failed me, Geordi. You were older. You were supposed to be the smart one."
He thought of Inej asking,
"Was there no one to protect you?"
He remembered Geordi seated beside him on a bridge, smiling and alive, the reflection of their feet in the water beneath them, the warmth of a cup of hot chocolate cradled in his mittened hands.
"We were supposed to look out for each other."
They'd been two farm boys, missing their father, lost in the city. That was how Pekka got them. It wasn't just the enticement of money. He'd given them a new home. A fake wife who'd made them Hutzput. A fake daughter for Kaz to play with. Pekka Rollins had lured them with a warm fire and the promise of the life they'd lost. And that was what destroyed you in the end. The longing for something you could never have. He scanned the faces of the people he had fought beside, bled with. He'd lied to them and been lied to. He'd brought them into hell and dragged them out again. Kaz settled his hands over his cane, his back to the city.
"We all want different things from this day. Freedom. Redemption."
"Cold hard cash?" suggested Jesper.
"Plenty of that.
There are lots of people looking to stand in our way. Van Eck, the Merchant Council, Pekka Rollins and his goons, a few different countries, and most of this saint-forsaken town."
"Is this supposed to be encouraging?" asked Nina.
"They don't know who we are. Not really. They don't know what we've done. What we've managed together." Kaz wrapped his cane on the ground. "So let's go show them they picked the wrong damn fight."
31. Wylan. "What am I doing here?" Wylan bent to the basin and splashed cold water on his face. In just a few hours, the auction would begin. They would abandon the hotel suite before dawn. It was imperative that if anyone came looking for Johannes Rietveld after the auction, they would find him long gone. He took a final glance in the bathroom's gilded mirror, The face gazing back at him was familiar again, but who was he really? A criminal? A runaway? A kid who was passable, maybe more than passable, at demo? I'm Maria Hendricks' son. He thought of his mother, alone, abandoned along with her defective child. Had she not been young enough to produce a proper heir? Had his father known even then that he would want to forever rid himself of any evidence that Wylan had existed? What am I doing here? But he knew the answer. Only he could see his father punished for what he'd done. Only he could see his mother freed. Wylan examined himself in the glass, his father's eyes, his mother's curls. It had felt good to be someone else for a while, to forget he was a Van Eck. But he didn't want to hide anymore. Ever since Pryor's fingers had closed over his throat, he'd been running. Or maybe it had started long before then, in the afternoons he'd spent sitting in the pantry or curled into a window seat behind a curtain, hoping everyone would forget him, that the nanny would just go home, that his tutor would never arrive. His father had wanted Wylan to vanish. He'd wanted him to disappear, the way he'd made Wylan's mother disappear. And for a long time, Wylan had wanted the exact same thing. That had all started to change when he came to the barrel, when he got his first job, when he met Jesper and Kaz and Inej. When he'd begun to realize he was worth something. Jan Van Eck was not going to get his wish. Wylan wasn't going anywhere. "I'm here for her," he said to the mirror. The rosy-cheeked boy in the glass did not look impressed. The sun had just started to rise as Pym led Wylan and Combe out the back of the hotel and through a series of confusing turns to the square that fronted the exchange. Ordinarily, the bakery on Bjurstrat would have been open at this hour, preparing to serve the traders and merchants on their way to the exchange. But the auction had upended ordinary business, and the baker had closed his shop. Maybe hoping to secure a seat to watch the proceedings for himself. They stood at the door on the deserted square for an excruciatingly long moment as Pym fumbled with the lock. Wylan realized he'd gotten used to the dexterity with which Kaz managed breaking and entering. The door opened with a too loud jingle, and then they were inside. "No mourners," said Pym. He vanished back through the door before Wylan could reply. The bakery cases were empty, but the smell of bread and sugar lingered. Wylan and Combe settled themselves on the floor with their backs against the shelves, trying to make themselves comfortable. Kaz had left them with strict instructions, and Wylan had no interest in disregarding them. Johannes Rietveld could never be seen in the city again, and Wylan knew exactly what his father would do to him if he found his son roaming the streets of Ketterdam. They sat in silence for hours. Combe dozed. Wylan hummed to himself a tune that he'd had in his head for a while. It would need percussion, something with a rat-a-tat-tat, like gunfire. He took a cautious peek through the window and saw a few people headed toward the Church of Barter, starlings taking flight in the square, and there, only a few hundred yards away, the entrance to the exchange. He didn't need to be able to read the words engraved over the arch. He'd heard his father repeat them countless times. Engent, vurhent, almhent. Industry, integrity, prosperity. Jan Van Eck had managed 2 out of 3 well enough. Wylan didn't realize Combe was awake until he said, "What made you lie for my son that day in the tomb?" Wylan lowered himself back down to the floor. He chose his words carefully. I guess I know what it's like to get things wrong. Colm sighed. Jesper gets a lot wrong. He's reckless and foolish and apt to joke when it's not warranted, but... Wyland waited. What I'm trying to say is he's a lot of trouble, a whole lot. But he's worth it. And it's my fault he is the way he is. I was trying to protect him, but maybe I saddled him with something worse than all the dangers I saw lurking out there. Even in the weak morning light trickling through the bakery's window, Wyland could see how weary Colm looked. I made some big mistakes. Wyland drew a line on the floor with his finger. You gave him someone to run to, no matter what he did or what went wrong. I think that's bigger than the big mistakes. See now, that's why he likes you. I know. It's none of my business, and I have no idea if he'd be good for you, probably bring you 10 kinds of headache. But I think you'd be good for him. Wyland's face heated. He knew how much Colm loved Jesper, had seen it in every gesture he'd made. It meant something that he thought Wyland was good enough for his son. A sound came from near the delivery entrance, and they both stilled. Wyland rose, heart pounding. "Remember," he whispered to Colm, "stay hidden." He made his way past the ovens to the back of the bakery. The smells were stronger here, the darkness more complete, but the room was empty. A false alarm. It's not. The delivery door flew open. Hands grabbed Wyland from behind. His head was yanked back, his mouth forced open as a rag was stuffed inside. A bag was shoved over his head. "Hey, little merch," said a deep voice he didn't recognize. "Ready to be reunited with your daddy?" They wrenched his arms back and dragged him through the delivery door of the bakery. Wyland stumbled, barely able to keep his footing, unable to see or get his bearings. He fell, his knees banging painfully against the cobblestones, and he was yanked back up. "Don't make me carry you, little merch. Not getting paid for that." "This way," said one of the others, a girl. "Pekka's on the southern side of the cathedral." "Hold," said a new voice. "Who do you have there?" His tone was officious. Stodwatch, Wyland thought. "Someone Councilman Van Eck is going to be very happy to see." "Is he from Kaz Brecker's crew?" "Just run along like a good grunt and tell him the Dime Lions have a present waiting for him in the armaments chapel." Wyland heard crowds a little way off. Were they near the church? A moment later, he was pulled roughly forward, and the sounds changed. They were inside. The air was cooler, the light dimmer. He was dragged up another set of stairs, his shins banging against their edges, and then shoved into a chair, his hands bound behind his back. He heard footsteps coming up the stairs, the sound of a door opening.
"We got him," said that same deep voice.
"Where?" Wyland's heart stuttered. "Sound it out, Wyland. A child half your age can read this without trying." He thought he was ready for this.
"Brecker had him stashed in a bakery just a few blocks away."
"How did you find him?"
"Pekka's had us searching the area. Figured Brecker might try to pull some stunt at the auction."
"No doubt intending to humiliate me," said Jan Van Eck. The bag was yanked from Wyland's head, and he looked into his father's face. Van Eck shook his head.
"Every time I think you cannot disappoint me further, you prove me wrong."
They were in a small chapel, topped by a dome. The oil paintings on the wall featured battle scenes and piles of armaments. The chapel must have been donated by a family of weapons manufacturers.
Over the last few days, Weiland had studied the layout of the Church of Barter, mapping the rooftop niches and alcoves with Inej, sketching the cathedral and long finger naves of Gazin's hand. He knew exactly where he was, one of the chapels at the end of Gazin's pinky. The floor was carpeted, the only door led to the stairway, and the only windows opened onto the roof. Even if he wasn't gagged, he doubted anyone but the paintings would be able to hear him cry for help. Two people stood behind Van Eck, a girl in striped trousers, the yellow hair shaved from half of her head, and a stout boy in plaid and suspenders. Both wore the purple armbands, indicating they'd been deputized by the Stodwatch. Both bore the Dime Lion tattoo. The boy grinned.
"You want me to go get Pekka?" he asked Van Eck.
"No need. I want him keeping his eyes on the preparations for the auction. And this is something I'd prefer to handle myself." Van Eck leaned down.
"Listen, boy, the Wraith was spotted with a member of the Grisha Triumvirate. I know Brekker is working with the Rovkins. For all your many shortcomings, you still carry my blood. Tell me what he has planned, and I'll see you're taken care of. You'll have an allowance. You can live somewhere in comfort. I'm going to remove your gag. If you scream, I'll let Pekka's friends do whatever they like to you. Understood?" Weiland nodded. His father tugged the rag from his mouth. Weiland ran his tongue over his lips and spat in his father's face. Van Eck drew a snowy, monogrammed handkerchief from his pocket. It was embroidered with the red laurel. An apt retort from a boy who can barely form words. He wiped the saliva from his face. "Let's try this again. Tell me what Brekker is planning with the Rovkins, and I may let you live. The way you let my mother live?"
His father's flinch was barely perceptible, a marionette yanked once by its strings, then allowed to return to rest. Van Eck folded his soiled handkerchief twice, tucked it away. He nodded to the boy and the girl. "Do whatever you have to. The auction starts in less than an hour, and I want answers before then."
"Hold him up," the stout boy said to the girl. She hauled Weiland to his feet, and the boy slipped a pair of brass knuckles from his pocket. "He's not going to be so pretty after this."
"Who is there to care?" Van Eck said with a shrug.
"Just make sure you keep him conscious. I want information."
The boy eyed Weiland skeptically.
"You sure you want to do it this way, little merch?"
Weiland summoned every bit of bravado he'd learned from Nina, the will he'd learned from Matthias, the focus he'd studied in Kaz, the courage he'd learned from Inej, and the wild, reckless hope he'd learned from Jesper. The belief that no matter the odds, somehow they would win.
"I won't talk," he said.
The first punch shattered two of his ribs. The second had him coughing blood.
"Maybe we should snap your fingers so you can't play that infernal flute," Van Eck suggested.
"I'm here for her," Weiland reminded himself. "I'm here for her." In the end, he was not Nina, or Matthias, or Kaz, or Inej, or Jesper. He was just Weiland Van Eck. He told them everything.
32. Inej. Getting into the Church of Barter was no easy task this morning, due to its position near the Exchange and the Burz Canal. Its roof didn't conjoin any others, and its entrances were already surrounded by guards when Inej arrived. But she was the Wraith. She was made to find the hidden places, the corners and cracks where no one thought to look. No weapons would be allowed inside the Church of Barter during the auction, so Jesper's rifle was secured to her back. She waited out of sight until she spotted a group of Stodwatch grunts rolling a cart full of lumber toward the church's huge double doors. Inej assumed they were the makings of some kind of barricade for the stage or the finger knaves. She waited until the cart had rolled to a stop, then tucked her hood into her tunic so it would not trail on the ground, and slipped beneath the cart. She latched herself onto the axle, her body bare inches above the cobblestones, and let them wheel her directly down the center aisle. Before they reached the altar, she dropped and rolled between the pews, narrowly missing the cart's wheels. The floor was cold stone under her belly as she crawled the width of the church, then waited at the end of the aisle and darted behind one of the columns of the western arcade. She moved from column to column, then slipped into the nave that would lead her to the thumb chapels. Once more, she dropped into a crawl so that she could use the pews in the nave as cover. She didn't know where the guards might be patrolling, and she had no desire to be caught simply wandering the church. She reached the first chapel, then climbed the stairs to the orange chapel above. Its altar was rendered in gold, but built to resemble crates of oranges and other exotic fruits. It framed a decapel oil that showed a family of merchants dressed in black, cradled in Gazan's hand, hovering over a citrus grove. She scaled the altar and launched herself up to the chapel's dome, clinging to it so she was hanging nearly upside down. Once she reached the center of the cupola, she wedged her back against the little dome that crowned the larger dome like a hat. Though she doubted she could be heard here, she waited until the sounds of sawing and hammering from the cathedral began, then positioned her foot in front of one of the slender glass windows that gave light to the chapel, and kicked. On the second attempt, the glass fractured, spilling outward. Inej covered her hand with her sleeve to clear away the excess shards, and etched out onto the top of the dome. She latched a climbing line to the window, and rappelled down the dome's side, to the roof of the nave, where she left Jesper's rifle. She didn't want it throwing off her balance. She was atop Gazan's thumb. The morning mist had started to burn away, and she could feel the day would be a hot one. She followed the thumb back to the steeply gabled spires of the main cathedral and began to climb once more. This was the highest part of the church, but the terrain was familiar, and that made for easier going. Of all the rooftops in Ketterdam, the cathedral was Inej's favorite. She'd had no good reason to learn its contours. There were plenty of other places from which she could have observed the exchange or the Burz Canal when a job called for it. But she'd always chosen the Church of Barter. Its spires were visible from almost anywhere in Ketterdam. The copper of its rooftop long since turned to green and crisscrossed by spines of metal scrollwork, full of perfect handholds and offering plenty of cover. It was like a strange gray-green fairyland that no one else in the city ever got to see. The wire walker in her had imagined running a line between its tallest spires.
Who would dare to defy death itself?
I will. The Kirch would probably consider staging acrobatics atop their cathedral blasphemous. Unless, of course, she charged admission. She planted the explosives Kaz had described as their insurance in the locations she and Wylan had agreed upon while mapping the cathedral. Only in Kaz's mind could chaos count for security. The bombs were meant to be noisy, but would do little damage. Still, if something went wrong and a distraction was needed, they would be there. When she was done, she took up her perch in one of the metalwork pockets that overlooked the apse and the vast nave of the cathedral. Here, her view of the proceedings would be obstructed by nothing but a series of wide slats and the mesh screen between them. There were times she came here just to listen to the music from the organ, or to hear voices raised in song. High above the city, chords from the pipe organ echoing through the stone. She felt closer to her saints. The acoustics were good enough that she could have listened to every word of the sermons if she'd wanted to, but she chose to ignore those parts of the service. Gazan was not her god, and she had no desire to be lectured on how she might better serve him. She wasn't fond of Gazan's altar, either, a graceless flat lump of rock around which the church had been built. Some called it the first forge, others the mortar. But today it would be used as an auction block. It made Inej's stomach turn. She was supposedly an indenture, brought to Kirch of her own free will. That was what the documents said. They didn't tell the story of her abduction, her terror in the belly of a slaver ship, the humiliation she'd suffered at Tanta Helene's hands, or the misery of her existence at the menagerie. Kirch had been built on trade, but how much of that trade had been the humankind? A minister of Gazan might stand at that altar and rail against slavery, but how much of this city had been built on taxes from the pleasure houses? How many members of his congregation employed boys and girls who could barely speak Kirch, who scrubbed floors and folded laundry for pennies as they worked to pay off a debt that never seemed to grow smaller? If Inej got her money, if she got her ship, she might do her part to change all of that. If she survived this day, she imagined all of them, Kaz, Nina, Matthias, Jesper, Wyland, Kuwei, who'd had so little say in the course of his own life, perched side by side on a wire, their balance precarious, their lives tethered together by hope and belief in one another. Pekka would be prowling the church below, and she suspected Dunyasha would be close by. She'd called the ivory and amber girl her shadow. But maybe she was a sign as well, a reminder that Inej hadn't been made for this life. And yet, it was hard not to feel that this city was her home, that Dunyasha was the intruder here. Now Inej watched the guards doing their last sweep of the church's ground floor, searching the corners and chapels. She knew they might send a few brave officers up to the roof to search, but there were plenty of places to hide. And if need be, she could simply slip back into the dome of the Thumb Chapel to wait them out. The guards set up their posts, and Inej heard the captain giving orders for where the members of the Merchant Council were to be seated on the stage. She spotted the university medic, who had been brought in to verify Kuwei's health, and saw a guard wheel a podium into place where the auctioneer would stand. She felt a surge of irritation when she spotted a few dime lions walking the aisles with the guards. They puffed out their chests, enjoying their new authority, brandishing the purple Stodwatch bands on their arms to one another, and laughing. The real Stodwatch didn't look pleased, and Inej could see at least two members of the Merchant Council observing the proceedings with a wary eye. Were they wondering if they'd gotten more than they'd bargained for, by allowing a bunch of barrel thugs to be deputized? Van Eck had started this dance with Rollins, but Inej doubted the King of the Barrel would let him lead for long. Inej scanned the skyline, all the way to the harbor and the black obelisk towers. Nina had been right about the Council of Tides. It seemed they preferred to stay cloistered in their watchtowers. Though, since their identities were unknown, Inej supposed they could be sitting in the cathedral right now. She looked toward the barrel, hoping Nina was safe and had not been discovered, that the heavy Stodwatch presence at the church would mean easier passage on the streets. By afternoon, the pews started to fill with curious onlookers, tradesmen in rough spun, jollies and bruisers fresh from the staves and decked out in their best barrel flash, flocks of black-clad merchers, some accompanied by their wives, their pale faces bobbing above their white lace collars, heads crowned by braids. The Fjärden diplomats came next. They wore silver and white and were bracketed by Druskala in black uniforms, all gilded hair and golden skin. Their size alone was daunting. Inej assumed that Matthias must know some of these men and boys. He would have served with them. What would it be like for him to see them again, now that he'd been branded a traitor? The Zemini delegation followed, empty gun belts at their hips, forced to divest themselves of their weapons at the doors. They were just as tall as the Druskala, but leaner of build, some bronze like her, others the same deep brown as Jesper, some with heads shorn, others with hair in thick braids and coiled knots. There, tucked between the last two rows of the Zemini, Inej caught sight of Jesper. For once he wasn't the tallest person in a crowd, and with the collar of his waxed cotton duster turned up around his jaw, and a hat pulled low over his ears, he was nearly unrecognizable. Or so Inej hoped. When the Rothkins arrived, the buzz in the room rose to a roar, What did the crowd of tradespeople, merchants, and barrel rowdies make of this grand international showing? A man in a teal frock coat led the Ravkin delegation, surrounded by a swarm of Ravkin soldiers in pale blue military dress. This had to be the legendary Sturmhand. He was pure confidence, flanked by Zoya Nazialensky on one side and Jenya Safin on the other, his stride easy and relaxed, as if he were taking a turn about one of his ships. Perhaps she should have met with the Ravkins when she'd had the chance. What might she learn in a month with Sturmhand's crew? The Fjärdens rose, and Inej thought a fight might break out, as the Druskala faced down the Ravkin soldiers. But two members of the Merchant Council rushed forward, backed by a troop of Sodwatch. "The Kurt is neutral territory," one of the merchants reminded them, his voice high and nervous. "We are here on matters of business, not war. Anyone who violates the sanctity of the Church of Barta will not be allowed to bid," insisted the other, black sleeves flapping.
"Why does your weak king send a filthy pirate to do his bidding?"
sneered the Fjärden ambassador, his words echoing across the cathedral.
"Privateer," corrected Sturmhand. "I suppose he thought my good looks would give me the advantage. Not a concern where you're from, I take it."
"Preening. Ridiculous peacock. You stink of Grisha foulness."
Sturmhand sniffed the air.
"I'm amazed you can detect anything over the reek of ice and inbreeding."
The ambassador turned purple, and one of his companions hastily drew him away. Inej rolled her eyes. They were worse than a couple of barrel bosses facing off on the staves. Bristling and grumbling, the Fjärdens and Ravkins took their seats on opposite sides of the aisle, and the Kalish delegation entered with little fanfare. But seconds later, everyone was on their feet again when someone shouted, "The shoe!" All eyes turned to the huge doors of the cathedral. As the shoe flowed inside, a tide of red banners marked with the horses and keys, their olive uniforms embellished with gold. Their expressions were stony as they marched up the aisle, then stopped as the shoe ambassador argued angrily that his delegation should be seated at the front of the room, and that they were giving the Ravkins and Fjärdens precedence by placing them closer to the stage. Were the Kergut among them? Inej glanced up at the pale spring sky. She did not like the idea of being plucked from her roost by a winged soldier. Eventually, Van Eck strode down the aisle from wherever he'd been lurking by the stage and snapped,
"If you wish to be seated in the front, you should have foregone the drama of a grand entrance and gotten here on time."
The shoe and the Kurch went back and forth a while longer, until at last the shoe settled in their seats. The rest of the crowd was crackling with murmurs and speculative glances. Most of them didn't know what Kuwe was worth, or had only heard rumors of the drug known as Jurda Parem, so they were left to wonder why a shoeboy had drawn such bitters to the table. The few merchants who had seated themselves in the front pews with the intention of placing a bid were exchanging shrugs and shaking their heads in bafflement. Clearly this was no game for casual players. The church bells began to chime three bells, just behind those from the Geldrenner clock tower. A hush fell. The merchant council gathered on the stage, and then Inej saw every head in the room turn. The great double doors of the church opened, and Kuwe Yulbo entered, flanked by Kaz and Matthias, and an armed Stodwatch escort. Matthias wore simple tradesman's clothes, but managed to look like a soldier on parade nevertheless. With his black eye and split lip, Kaz looked even less reputable than usual, despite the sharp lines of his black suit. The shouting began immediately. It was hard to know who was causing the loudest uproar. The most wanted criminals in the city were striding down the center aisle of the Church of Barter. At the first glimpse of Kaz, the dime lions stationed throughout the cathedral started booing. Matthias had instantly been recognized by his Druskala brethren, who were yelling what Inej presumed were insults at him in Fjärden. The sanctity of the auction would protect Kaz and Matthias, but only until the final gavel fell. Even so, neither of them seemed remotely concerned. They walked with backs straight and eyes forward, Kuei safely wedged between them. Kuei was faring less well. The shoe was screaming the same word again and again. She Yao, She Yao. And whatever it meant, with every shout, Kuei seemed to curl further in on himself. The city auctioneer approached the raised dais and took his place at the podium next to the altar. It was Yellen Rodmacher, one of the investors they had invited to Jesper's absurd presentation on oil futures. From the investigation she'd done for Kaz, Inej knew that he was scrupulously honest, a devout man with no family except an equally pious sister who spent her days scrubbing the floors of public buildings in service to Gazan. He was pale, with tufty orange brows and a hunched posture that gave him the look of a giant shrimp. Inej scanned the undulating spires of the cathedral, the rooftops of the finger naves radiating from Gazan's palm. Still no patrol on the roof. It was almost insulting. But maybe Pekka Rollins and Jan Van Eck had something else planned for her. Rodmacher brought his gavel down in three furious swings.
"There will be order!" he bellowed.
The clamor in the room dulled to a discontented murmur. Kuei, Kaz, and Matthias climbed to the stage and took their places by the podium, Kaz and Matthias partially blocking the still-shaking Kuei from view. Rodmacher waited for absolute quiet. Only then did he begin to recite the rules of the auction, followed by the terms of Kuei's proffered indenture. Inej glanced at Van Eck. What was it like for him to be so close to the prize he'd sought for so long? His expression was smug, eager. He's already calculating his next move, Inej realized. As long as Ravka did not have the winning bid, and how could they, with their war chest badly depleted, Van Eck would get his wish, the secret of Gerda Parem unleashed upon the world. The price of Gerda would rise to unimaginable heights, and between his secret private holdings and his investments in the Gerda Consortium, run by Johannes Rietveld, he would be rich beyond all dreaming. Rodmacher waved forward a medic from the university, a man with a shiny bald pate. He took Kuei's pulse, measured his height, listened to his lungs, examined his tongue and teeth. It was a bizarre spectacle, uncomfortably close to Inej's memory of being prodded and poked by Tanta Helene on the deck of a slaver ship. The medic finished and closed up his bag.
"Please make your declaration," said Rodmacher.
"The boy's health is sound."
Rodmacher turned to Kuei.
"Do you freely consent to abide by the rules of this auction and its outcome?"
If Kuei replied, Inej couldn't hear it.
"Speak up, boy!"
Kuei tried again.
"I do."
"Then let us proceed."
The medic stepped down and Rodmacher lifted his gavel once more.
"Kuei Yul Bo freely gives his consent to these proceedings and hereby offers his service for a fair price as guided by Gazan's hand. All bids will be made in Kruga. Bidders are instructed to keep silence when not making offers. Any interference in this auction, any bid made in less than good faith, will be punished to the fullest extent of Kirch law. The bidding will start at 1,000,000 Kruga.
He paused.
"In Gazan's name, let the auction commence."
And then it was happening, a clamor of numbers Inej could barely track, the bids climbing as Rodmacher jabbed his gavel at each bidder, repeating the offers in staccato bursts.
5,000,000 Kruga,
the shoe ambassador shouted.
5,000,000,
repeated Rodmacher.
"Do I have 6?
6,
the Fjerdens countered. Rodmacher's bark ricocheted off the cathedral walls like gunfire. Sturmhand waited, letting the Fjerdens and shoe bat numbers back and forth, the Zemini delegate occasionally upping the price in more cautious increments, trying to slow the bidding's momentum. The Kalish sat quietly in their pews, observing the proceedings. Inej wondered how much they knew, and if they were unwilling or simply unable to bid. People were standing now, unable to keep to their seats. It was a warm day, but the activity in the cathedral seemed to have driven the temperature higher. Inej could see people fanning themselves, and even the members of the Merchant Council, gathered like a jury of magpies, had begun to dab at their brows. When the bidding hit 40,000,000 Kruga, Sturmhand finally raised his hand.
50 million kruger, he said. The Church of Barter fell silent. Even Rodmacher paused, his cool demeanor shaken, before he replied,
50 million kruger, from the Ravkun delegation.
The members of the Merchant Council were whispering to one another behind their palms, no doubt thrilled at the commission they were about to earn on Kuei's price.
Do I hear another offer?
Rodmacher asked. The Shu were conferring. The Fjerdans were doing the same, though they seemed to be arguing more than discussing. The Zemini appeared to be waiting to see what would happen next.
60 million kruger,
the Shu declared. A counter-raise of 10 million, just as Kaz had anticipated. The Fjerdans offered next at 60,200,000. You could see it cost their pride something to move in such a small increment. But the Zemini seemed eager to cool down the bidding, too. They bid at 60,500,000. The rhythm of the auction changed, climbing at a slower pace, hovering below 62 million until at last that milestone was reached, and the Shu seemed to grow impatient.
70 million kruger, said the Shu ambassador.
80 million, called Sturmhand.
90 million.
The Shu weren't bothering to wait for Rodmacher now. Even from her perch, Inej could see Kuei's pale, panic-stricken face. The numbers had gone too high, too fast.
91 million,
Sturmhand said in a belated attempt to slow the pace. As if he'd grown tired of the game, the Shu ambassador stepped forward and roared,
110 million kruger! 110 million kruger from the Shu delegation!
Cried Rodmacher, his calm obliterated by the sum.
Do I hear another offer?
The Church of Barter was silent, as if all those assembled had bent their heads in prayer. Sturmhand gave a jagged-edged laugh and shrugged.
120 million kruger!
Inej bit her lip so hard she drew blood.
Boom!
The massive double doors blew open. A wave of seawater crashed through into the nave, frothing between the pews, then vanishing in a cloud of mist. The crowd's excited chatter turned to startled cries. 15 figures cloaked in blue filed inside, their robes billowing as if captured by an invisible wind, their faces obscured in mist. People were calling for their weapons. Some were clutching one another and screaming. Inej saw a mercher hunched over, frantically fanning his unconscious wife. The figures glided up the aisle, their garments moving in slow ripples.
"We are the Council of Tides," said the blue-cloaked figure in the lead,
a female voice, low and commanding. The mist shrouded her face completely, shifting beneath her hood in a continuously changing mask.
"This auction is a sham."
Shocked murmurs rose from the crowd. Inej heard Rodmacher call for order, and then she was dodging left, moving on instinct, as she heard a soft whoosh. A tiny circular blade cut past her, slicing the sleeve of her tunic and pinging off the copper roof.
"That was a warning," said Dunyasha.
She perched on the scrollwork of one of the spires 30 feet from Inej, her ivory hood raised around her face, bright as new snow beneath the afternoon sun.
"I will look you in the eye when I send you to your death."
Inej reached for her knives. Her shadow demanded an answer. Part 6. Action and Echo.
33. Matthias. Matthias held his body quiet, taking in the chaos that had erupted over the Church of Barter. He was keenly aware of the council members seated behind him, a flock of black-suited ravens squawking at one another, each louder than the next, all but Van Eck, who had settled deeply into his chair, his fingers tented before him, a look of supreme satisfaction on his face. Matthias could see the man called Pekka Rollins leaning on a column in the eastern arcade. He suspected that the gang boss had deliberately positioned himself in Kaz's line of vision. Rodmacher demanded order, his voice rising, the tufts of his pale orange hair quivering with every bang of his gavel. It was hard to tell what had riled up the room more, the possibility that the auction was fixed, or the appearance of the Council of Tides. Kaz claimed that no one knew the identities of the Tides, and if Dirty Hands and the Wraith could not suss out such a secret, then no one could. Apparently, they had last appeared in public 25 years before to protest the proposed destruction of one of the obelisk towers to create a new shipyard. When the vote had not gone in their favor, they'd sent a huge wave to crush the Stadthall. The council had reversed themselves, and a new Stadthall had been erected on the old site, one with fewer windows and a stronger foundation. Matthias wondered if he would ever grow used to such stories of Grisha power. "It's just another weapon. Its nature depends on who wields it," he would have to keep reminding himself. The thoughts of hatred were so old they had become instincts. That was not something he could cure overnight. Like Nina with Parem, it might well be a lifelong fight. By now, she would be deep into her assignment in the barrel. Or she might have been discovered and arrested. He sent up a prayer to Jell. "Keep her safe while I cannot." His eyes strayed to the Fjärden delegation gathered in the front pews and the Druskala there. He knew many of them by name, and they certainly knew him. He could feel the sharp edge of their disgust. One boy glared at him from the first row, quivering with fury, eyes like glaciers, hair so blonde it was nearly white. What wounds had his commanders exploited to put that look in his eyes? Matthias held his gaze steadily, taking the brunt of his rage. He could not hate this boy. He'd been him. Eventually, the ice-haired boy looked away.
"The auction is sanctioned by law," shouted the shoe ambassador. "You have no right to stop the proceedings."
The tide makers raised their arms. Another wave crashed through the open doors and roared down the aisle, arcing over the heads of the shoe and hovering there.
"Silence!"
demanded the lead tide maker. She waited for another protest, and when none came, the wave curled backward and sloshed harmlessly to the floor. It slithered up the aisle like a silver snake.
"We have received word that these proceedings have been compromised."
Matthias's eyes darted to Sturmhond. The privateer had schooled his features into mild surprise, but even from the stage, Matthias could sense his fear and worry. Kuei was trembling, eyes closed, whispering to himself in Shu. Matthias could not tell what Kaz was thinking. He never could.
"The rules of the auction are clear," said the tide maker. "Neither the indenture nor his representatives are permitted to interfere with the auction's outcome. The market must decide."
The members of the Merchant Council were on their feet now, demanding answers, gathering around Rodmacher at the front of the stage. Van Eck made a great show of shouting along with the others, but he paused beside Kaz, and Matthias heard him murmur, "Here I thought I would have to be the one to reveal your scheme with the Rovkins, but it seems the Tides will have the honor." His mouth curved in a satisfied smile. "Wyland took quite a beating before he gave you and your friends up," he said, moving toward the podium. "I never knew the boy had so much spine."
"A false fund was created to swindle honest merchants out of their money," continued the tide maker. "That money was funneled to one of the bidders."
"Of course," said Venek, in mock surprise. "The Rovkins. We all knew they didn't have the funds to bid competitively in such an auction."
Matthias could hear how greatly he was enjoying himself.
"We're aware of how much money the Rovkin crown has borrowed from us over the last 2 years. They can barely make their interest payments. They don't have 120 million Kruger ready to bid in an open auction. Brekka must be working with them."
All the bidders were out of their seats now. The Fjärdens were shouting for justice. The shoe had begun stamping their feet and banging on the backs of the pews. The Rovkin stood in the middle of the maelstrom, surrounded by enemies on every side. Sturmhond, Jenya, and Zoya were at the center of it all, chins held high.
"Do something," Matthias growled at Kaz. "This is about to turn ugly."
Kaz's face was as impassive as always.
"Do you think so?"
damn it, Pricker. You... The tides raised their arms and the church shook with another resonant boom. Water sloshed in through the windows of the upper balcony. The crowd quieted, but the silence was hardly complete. It seethed with angry murmurs. Rodmacher banged his gavel, attempting to